Cheney and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have.
We made it to another month here on Legal Face Off. We're still on Zoom. I don't know. Are we ever going to go back into the studio? I'm not exactly sure. Rich Linkoff, Tina Martini. My name is Sam Panionovich. Ben Anderson is behind the glass. Do we have an answer to that? Can we ever go home? Can we ever go back to WGN?
I'm sorry. Home is where I am.
That's fair.
Someday Rich? We'll have a field trip to WGN. Just don't know when.
Don't know if we're ever going back, but we plug along on Legal Face Off.
That's for sure. Anything you may have missed, you can always go back to the website, WGNradio.com, and check out past episodes. Today, we're going to talk about the Hatch Act right off the top. We'll talk about a Chicago judge running for state's attorney in Cook County, and also Chicago home sharing and looting charges before the legal grab bag. But joining us to kick things off today, she is the legal counsel at the Campaign Legal Center. She is Delaney Marsco. Delaney, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
So, Delaney, the Republican National Convention that was held last week has made a lot of headlines because of the rather unusual way in which it was run. And it's not just because it was virtual due to COVID. There's also been a lot of talk about the Hatch Act in the context of the RNC. What is the Hatch Act?
Sure. So the Hatch Act is a law that's been on the books for over 80 years now. And its full title is actually an act to prevent pernicious political activities, which I love that name. And the purpose of the act, the Hatch Act, is to ensure that government service remains a public trust by preventing officials from using their official resources or their official authority for any partisan political purpose. And the Hatch Act has civil and criminal provisions. And for purposes of what we've been talking about with the RNC, and I think in general with kind of the Trump administration, I like to think of the Hatch Act as kind of covering three buckets of prohibited conduct. One is engaging in political activity while on duty or in a federal building. And this covers all federal employees except the president, the vice president, and some certain high-level employees. The second bucket of prohibited conduct is using official authority or influence to affect the result of an election. This part of the act kind of prohibits the use of an official title while engaged in political activity. Think of the repeated Kellyanne Conway violations where she was using her official title in front of the White House and then, you know, talking about the primary election. That kind of stuff is prohibited by that second bucket. And then the third bucket is the criminal provision. The first two kind of cover the civil, the part of the act. And then the third bucket prohibits commanding or coercing or intimidating a federal employee into engaging in any of those political activities. So you can't threaten a federal employee. For example, the president can't say, I will fire you if you don't write this campaign speech for me. That's illegal. And every federal employee is covered by that provision, including the president and the vice president.
Delaney, what got a lot of attention last week, as Tina mentioned, was during the Republican National Convention, which was, of course, online. We saw Mike Pompeo, who's the Secretary of State, give a speech. Now, it was pre-recorded. It was in Jerusalem, but, you know, in favor of the campaign and aired during the convention. That seems to violate the Hatch Act. It also seems to violate the very instructions that Mike Pompeo himself gave in a memo that you can read online to the State Department, where he unequivocally says among the things you can't do that would violate the Hatch Act are appear at a convention. So, you know, it seems like his lawyers may now be trying to justify by saying, well, it wasn't during the convention because it was pre-recorded and it wasn't on federal property because it was in Jerusalem. To me, that's, you know, complete nonsense and complete. What he did was completely in violation of the spirit of the Hatch Act.
Yeah. I mean,
it's not, not the letter of it, by the way.
Right. And you're absolutely right. It's definitely a violation of his own agency's policies and the spirit of the Hatch Act. But, you know, what we've seen the Trump administration do repeatedly, and particularly with the convention, is kind of use these technicalities of the Hatch Act to make things seem above board, right? So, yeah, if for, you know, if somehow Secretary Pompeo didn't use any official resources or any of his subordinates' time to, you know, make this RNC speech happen, and he didn't use his official title when he was giving the speech, you know, kind of all of these like technicalities, it's possible that he didn't violate the letter of the law. And they've just said the same thing about kind of using the White House lawn, right? Like the OSC has said, you know, well, actually official business isn't typically conducted on the White House lawn. So it's okay. And just because you can do something doesn't mean you should do something. You know, I can get a tattoo of, you know, Trump's name across my forehead. Should I do that? Probably not, right? I mean, just because it's legal doesn't mean you should do it. And for purposes of the Hatch Act and for purposes of, you know, our democracy, we've relied on a combination of norms and law to make sure that public service remains a public trust, right? We just expect that the presidents and kind of every president up until Trump has are going to keep their political activity separate from their official activity, because the public needs to trust that the government is working for everybody and it's free from partisan political influence. And so what's happening with the Hatch Act is just kind of the norms are being shattered. You know, the expectation that the president would behave as though the law applies to him, he's not behaving like that.
So Delaney, what do you do? I mean, say that, you know, someone decides that, or, you know, Congress decides, who decides when a violation of the Hatch Act occurs, and what's the remedy here? You mentioned Kellyanne Conway from a number of months back, and she was sort of saying, try to take a piece of me with respect to the Hatch Act, you know, have at it, see you in jail sort of thing. So what do you do when someone violates the Hatch Act, and what's the remedy here?
Yeah, she used a very legal and technical term, blah, blah, blah.
right, blah, 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 well-known term of art. So unfortunately, we have two systems of enforcement for the Hatch Act. You know, the Hatch Act applies to all federal workers across the country. It applies to postal workers across the country, VA employees, veterans, like everyone, millions of people. And for most of those employees, the Hatch Act isn't optional, right? We have a independent agency called the Office of Special Counsel. They're charged with investigating possible violations. And OSC can prosecute essentially alleged violations, civil violations, before a quasi-judicial body called the Merit Systems Protection Board. And for civil violations, penalties are pretty severe. They can include removal, that you can be debarred from federal service for 5 years, and there's also like civil fines. So these are serious consequences for most employees, where, you know, it isn't theoretical. We see folks at the VA and USPS getting fired, getting barred from federal service, you know, with some frequency. But the most senior officials, those who work at the White House, don't face this kind of quasi-judicial process. For Senate-confirmed appointees, OSC can only refer findings of violations to the president, who is then in charge of disciplinary action. And we know with the Kellyanne Conway situation that he's not interested in enforcing the Hatch Act. And, you know, separately for the criminal side, criminal violations, which the president, you know, is bound by the criminal provisions of the Hatch Act, the president's own Justice Department would be responsible, you know, for investigating and prosecuting those violations. And not only has the department, you know, taken the position that the president is immune from prosecution while he's in office, it seems unlikely that this Justice Department would have any interest in prosecuting a Hatch Act, criminal Hatch Act violation.
She is Delaney Marsco, legal counsel at the Campaign Legal Center. Delaney, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
We all know the legal world is complex and high pressure. There's no room for error. That's why judges and attorneys across Chicagoland have trusted the expert court reporters at McCorkle Litigation Services since 1948. McCorkle Litigation Services has accurately recorded every word from thousands of legal proceedings. McCorkle Litigation Services provides the legal community with peace of mind, transcribing testimony and depositions that can be used reliably by jurors, judges, and attorneys. For all your legal support needs, contact McCorkle Litigation Services online at McCorkleLitigation.com.
You can like us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter. And after you listen, please rate and review the show. It is Legal Face-Off with the Legal Eagles here on WGN. And returning to the show, he's been on multiple times. He's the alderman of the 42nd Ward. That's downtown in Chicago. He's been the vice mayor, and he's also been in the city council in Chicago since 2007. That's the alderman, Brendan Riley, returning to the show. What's up, alderman?
Hey, guys, how are you?
Great, Alderman. Thanks for joining us again on Legal Face-Off. So one of the hot topics that you're on the forefront in is Airbnb and other home-sharing sites. There was a measure introduced that you supported putting some more restrictions on those companies, including banning one-night stays. Talk to us about why you think that's important.
Sure. And actually, I won't take credit for authoring the ordinance. Alderman Michelle Smith wrote it. But I've been really involved in the issue because I wrote the very first ordinance that governed this industry before it really existed. The first ordinance I passed actually passed before Airbnb was a corporation. Back when I had to deal with this, it was a quality of life issue for condominium high-rise owners. Craigslist was the platform then. But what we were having were strangers moving into residential communities for one night only and treating it as such. And so we had a lot of quality of life complaints and issues with that. So fast forward to now, we've had an ineffective law in place for several years, allowing hosts to go and list their units before the city's even cleared them as legitimate. Lots of violations in residential buildings, even though we have prohibitions now. So I think this ordinance works to tighten up certain components that were being exploited as loopholes. You know, the one night rental thing isn't really a big issue for me. I think the bigger issue that we didn't address in this ordinance is having owner occupied units. All the concerns about party houses and these things being abused, those evaporate if someone actually lives in the home. And when it's positioned by Airbnb and their public relations folks, it's all about helping that person make a little extra income to get by. I'm sympathetic. But then that means let's rent out that room in the house or over the garage. We live there. There should not be a mechanism for landlord investors who own lots and lots of condo units to just rent those out and wreak havoc on their condominium neighbors while they live in California or Florida. So I'm not against the industry. I just think it needs to be properly regulated so that their neighbors have some protections and some guarantees that they're living in a residential community and environment.
So, Alderman, let's turn to the recent looting in Chicago that's become a huge problem. You wrote in a recent letter to your ward residents that Kim Fox is treating laws like a buffet in terms of selectively enforcing some and not others. This is in the wake of a Tribune report from a few weeks ago that demonstrated that Fox is dropping felony cases involving charges of murder and other serious offenses at a higher rate than her predecessor. What does she need to do differently to hold criminals accountable so that hopefully we can turn the tide on this and demonstrate that crimes will not be tolerated?
Well, the first thing she needs to do is throw the book at violent criminals. Look, I think there's a lot of people, I think there's popular support for reform with juvenile justice, truly nonviolent crimes, selling small amounts of marijuana, these sorts of things. But if you're committing a crime with a gun or you're committing a violent crime, period, there have to be very, very harsh consequences for that, especially for the first offender. My whole thing is if there aren't consequences and accountability for bad acts, it's going to continue. The police department is working overtime, literally, to catch the bad guys. Problem is, they're catching the same bad guys over and over and over again, committing the exact same crimes because there aren't any consequences. So for me, this isn't personal. I think Kim Fox is a very good person, but we need an aggressive prosecutor. That's the job. We have a public defender. We need a strong prosecutor so that police know when they put in the hard work and get those bad guys, they're going to go in due time. And the hope is eventually people will stop breaking these laws because there are stiff consequences for them. Without that, we should expect more lawlessness. And so that is a big part of it. That and our Cook County judges need to step up both in bond court and in sentencing. That's really an important component too.
Alderman, I was driving through your ward, which again includes some of the most famous and iconic parts of Chicago, the Mag Mile, lots of downtown commercial spots the other day. And I was really, it was really early in the morning. I was surprised at how much police presence there was, which was great, but it felt really strange. You know, your ward is home to some of the most, like I said, iconic retail establishments in Chicago, some of which have, you know, been decimated by the looting. Macy's, Bloomingdale's, you know, some people I think come to Chicago every single day just to visit that Water Tower Macy's. Macy's has intimated that they will be leaving the city. We've also seen record numbers of residential folks, people who live in Chicago and especially in your ward, fleeing the city, right? Because of high taxes, property taxes and crime. That's got to have a devastating effect on your ward. Talk to us a little bit about what happens when residents and businesses like Macy's, like Bloomingdale's, leave your ward and never come back, by the way.
So I represent the 42nd ward, which is almost 60% of the city's economy is here. I represent about 40,000 business licenses, about 100,000 people, and it's the engine for the city. You don't want to hear news about retailers accelerating plans to shut down stores or declare bankruptcy. We both know Macy's has been struggling for quite some time. The pandemic was a big, big blow. But then the devastation of two separate rioting and looting incidents in Chicago, I think they had to look at their real estate decisions sooner and make tougher choices faster. And I think that there are other major retailers in the exact same spot. It's a deposit of both the pandemic and the civil unrest coming to a head at once. And so that's a major concern for me. I don't want to send the wrong message to folks about however. We still have new businesses opening literally every single day during COVID in the ward that I represent. And on average, I add about 3,500 new residents to my ward each year. Now, obviously, that's slowed down a bit. And you're right, there are listings to sell condominium units downtown. That could be a combination of factors. Another one is the economy. A lot of folks that live downtown live here to be close to their office. Well, with the pandemic and a vaccine not on the horizon, it's very, very reasonable to expect that there'll be a lot more remote working and the potential of more stay-at-home quarantine stuff. Well, would you rather have an acre and a half yard to be quarantined in, or do you want to be on your balcony in your high rise? And so it's a combination of factors. I'm not sounding the alarm bell yet. Bottom line, we cannot have a repeat of the looting that occurred. Once was too many. And so I think what you're seeing downtown is a hardening of our landscape, literally to protect our retail corridors here, but also in the neighborhoods. I'm getting smarter about barricade usage, water trucks, these sorts of things to close off quarters if necessary, take some pressure off the cops. We're also getting better at intelligence, social media monitoring, so we know when these things are being planned as they're being planned. All those things are important, but everyone downtown, whether you're a business owner or a resident, you deserve to be safe here. And it still remains one of the safest places in the entire city of Chicago. We need to keep it that way and make sure we do not have these repeat looting incidents. That's totally unacceptable and it's criminal.
So, Alderman, last quick question here on Legal Face-Off. We're about to hit the Labor Day weekend, and I think everybody is really concerned, to your point, that we're going to have other instances of violence and looting, especially looking at what's happened the past several months. What does Mayor Lightfoot and what does the Chicago Police Department need to do to try to stem the tide and to mitigate the risk associated with more looting?
Well, specifically to looting, a little bit about that with the use of barricades. We actually are in the process now of identifying funding sources for a longer-term solution. So imagine decorative bollards up and down Michigan Avenue, screwable, removable bollards at major intersections where they can be quickly installed, or even raised electric directly to close off vehicular traffic. Those are investments we're going to make now. It'll take a few months to implement those. In the immediate future, though, you can expect to see a very heavy police presence, not just downtown, but in the neighborhood commercial corridors. So that's all the kind of stuff you can count on right now. But as far as, you know, intelligence gathering capabilities, we're just getting warmed up on that. When it comes to violent crime in the neighborhoods, especially the shootings that are epidemic, we have good partners in the FBI, DEA, ATF, and that's the kind of federal support I'll take all day long. They're doing great work charging felons federally to circumvent the county justice system, to make sure that these folks actually go to prison. So all the developments, this is a very, very challenging time, not just for Chicago, but for cities around the country. We're all doing the best we can to manage this stuff on the fly because of the unpredictability of this environment. But I can tell you the mayor's committed to it. I certainly am. And the police department has been working round the clock to tighten up these plans and make sure we don't have a repeat incident.
That is Alderman Brendan Riley from Chicago's 42nd Ward. Alderman, we always appreciate you making time for us. Thanks.
Thanks for having me, guys. Take care.
Rich Lenkoff is an attorney with Bryce Downey & Lenkoff. Rich is consistently recognized by clients like United Airlines, McDonald's, Macy's, Dollar Tree, and the Chicago Bears for his outstanding litigation results. In 2015, Target named him their top outside litigation attorney in the country. Rich has received a number of industry accolades, including Illinois Super Lawyer from 2015 through 2019 and Leading Lawyer from 2012 through 2020. Designations given to less than 5% of Illinois attorneys. Rich is also an active member of his community, including serving on organizations like the Advisory Board of Legal Prep Charter Academy and the Board of Visitors for the Northern Illinois University College of Law. In addition to his full-time practice, Rich is a prolific producer with credits including Elvis Presley's Heartbreak Hotel, 85, the greatest team in football history, starring Barack Obama, Bill Murray, and the coach, Mike Ditka. And Renegades, a live show in Las Vegas starring Terrell Owens, Jose Canseco, and Jim McMahon. In addition to co-hosting Legal Faceoff since 2013, Rich is the legal analyst for The John Williams Show on WGN Radio. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service litigation firm practicing general liability, workers' compensation, professional malpractice, business transactions, and intellectual property, among other practice areas. For more information about Rich and Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, please visit bdlfirm.com. That's bdlfirm.com.
Our final guest before the legal grab bag is Judge Pat O'Brien, who is a lifelong Chicagoan, attended St. Ignatius High School, Notre Dame, DePaul, and he's now running for Cook County State's Attorney. The website to learn more is o'brienforcook.com. Judge, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, and I appreciate being on and obviously being able to talk to all the hundreds and thousands of persons who are going to be listening to you.
We wish. So thank you so much, Judge. We appreciate your time. So last summer, you announced that you would be running for Cook County State's Attorney against the incumbent Kim Fox. You've had a long and prestigious legal career, including in private practice, as well as working a couple of times in the Cook County State's Attorney's Office. And most recently, you've served as a judge. What made you decide that you wanted to throw your hat into the ring and run against Fox?
Well, I was having coffee with another former assistant state's attorney and former judge, and our phones beeped at the same time, and we saw the alert that the Smollett case had been dismissed by the state's attorney's office. We were both astonished. I started looking at the office itself, and obviously in the days that followed, we learned more information about the Smollett case, and it just seemed to me that there was no way that a state's attorney could obviously get another 4 years in office after she had given a special sweetheart deal to somebody who was politically connected.
Judge, we want to get into Smollett in a little bit more detail, but, you know, obviously we're entering a Labor Day weekend. It's going to be a long weekend. It's going to be a violent weekend. There's no question that it's going to be full of crime, shootings, murder. That's obviously going to be on your plate should you convince the voters of Cook County to elect you here in a few weeks. Also, you know, we just talked to Alderman Brendan Riley about the effect of the looting and rioting on his ward, on the city in general. finally, we also discussed the recent Tribune report that detailed how Kim Fox has been far more lenient than her predecessor in allowing felons or people charged with felons out of jail and not charging them at all. So I know that's a big mouthful, but what are your thoughts on those really key issues facing your race?
You know, the state's attorneys and the state's attorney's office is a key player in criminal justice system. They are the only entity in the county that can actually charge felony offenses. They are responsible to determine when people are charged, if in fact they're keeping the conditions of bond, if they're out on bond. They're the only entity that can get cases moving to disposition. And at the time of trial or plea, they're the only office that really has the power to reduce offenses, to have assistants hopefully well-trained to represent victims. And in murder cases where victims have no voice, state's attorneys who make those arguments are their voice. So they are a key and essential player. And even as part of that, the three parts where they essentially play a central role, they depend upon the police to investigate and bring and arrest people and bring that evidence to them to determine whether they're going to be charged. They can't be at war with the police. You can still police the police and determine if there's excessive force that those officers will be held accountable, but you can't be at war with them. You cannot.
Specifically, I'm just going to interrupt you, but specifically, you know, what's on a lot of people's minds, especially as we get to this weekend, is, you know, looting and rioting. And we see it in Kenosha. We saw it in Chicago that destroyed a large part of our city. If you were a Cook County state's attorney, would you be less lenient than Kim Fox is? Would you be more aggressive in not only prosecuting these offenders, but making sure that they serve some significant time?
Well, the state's attorney, if you want to characterize it as lenient or more aggressive, I think the appropriate thing is, would I obey the oath of office, which is basically to hold people accountable when they violate the law? And the answer is absolutely. And these riots, the first statement I would make prior to the weekend starting is publicly tell everyone that if you violate the law, you're going to be held accountable. If you're peacefully protesting, you're going to be protected, and they're essentially, you have the right to do that. And if you're arrested on looting, burglary, battery to police, there's going to be a request for a no bond for at least a couple of days where it can be reviewed later after order has been restored. So you're not going to send people that are arrested for looting and other kinds of riotous behavior back into an ongoing rioting situation.
So, Judge, let's turn to Smollett for a moment. I mean, obviously, there's been a lot of airplay with this one. What do you think about the special prosecutor Dan Webb's report? And do you think that it should have been released? We'd love to get your take on that.
Well, I think what it showed was that although we didn't find that there were criminal offenses that were committed by Fox or anybody in the office, he did find that she lied a number of times to the public to try to hide from them the fact that Smollett was a one-of-a-kind political deal. And that all points to the question of whether she should continue to hold a law license given these lies. And obviously, the disciplinary commission is going to make that determination, but they probably need that report. So I would think that at some point, whether it's based upon their request or presently Dan Webb is trying to get the judge to review his ruling, that report has got to get to, at a minimum, the disciplinary commission. And I think also the public deserves to see it so they know whether, when they come to vote, whether they're voting for somebody who might lose their law license.
Judge, you're a Republican in a very Democrat city. How would you, if elected Cook County State's Attorney, work closely with the leaders of our city, including Democrat Mayor Lori Lightfoot and Tony Preckwinkle, who would be someone you'd be working obviously close with in her role as chairperson of Cook County Commission?
when I was in the state's attorney's office for 13 years, I worked for four different state's attorneys, two Republicans and two Democrats. So I don't know that this particular office, which has a kind of unique role, is really a Democratic or Republican office. And as for working with elected officials like the mayor or Tony Preckwinkle, I see no problem in doing that. Everybody has a stake in making sure that this city is viable, that the neighborhoods are protected, and that victims have a voice. So I don't see that as necessarily being a problem. And quite frankly, I've run as a Democrat for a judge. I'm in a situation where I'm exactly like the voters I want to appeal to. I'm a Republican who believes in personal responsibility, and I've been a Democrat, and I believe that the Democrats and independents need somebody who's going to be a voice for the safety of the community.
Judge, last question on Legal Face-Off. Obviously, voter turnout is always an issue, especially when you're running against an incumbent, especially in Cook County. Kim Fox certainly has an advantage there. In the times that we're living in, given people are not leaving their house, given people are scared to go to the polling booth because of COVID and perhaps even because of some of the crime we see, how will you get out your supporters and potential voters to support you in a few weeks?
Well, we're on the road to raising $1 million. And obviously the message has to be pushed out there so that people know that there's a realistic and a credible alternative to what they see in Kim Fox. So we're going to do that. And I hope that the voters understand that their safety, the safety of the city, obviously all of the communities that are at risk, they need somebody who's going to speak for them. And it's not Kim Fox. She favors criminals over the victims. And that isn't what a state's attorney should be doing.
That's Judge Pat O'Brien running for Cook County State's Attorney. You can learn more at O'Brienforcook.com. Judge, thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you all, and I appreciate the opportunity.
You are listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face-Off. Dina is a partner at McDermott, Will & Emery and focuses her practice on domestic and international trademark and copyright law, as well as domain name, internet, social media, advertising, and unfair competition law. Tina has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubbell and being selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications, including Chambers & Partners and World Trademark Review. Tina is also the recipient of the Anti-Defamation League's Women of Achievement Award and has been recognized by Crain's Chicago Business as one of Chicago's most influential minority lawyers. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is an author, columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host, and she frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current issues and trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. McDermott, Will & Emery is an integrated international law firm. McDermott has an uncompromising commitment to legal excellence, extraordinary client service, and a high-performance culture. It is committed to helping clients achieve stellar legal and business results today and well into the future. To contact Tina and to learn more about McDermott, Will & Emery, visit MWE.com.
It is time for the legal grab bag on Legal Face-Off. Thanks to Emily and Gabby and Ben, per usual, for all their hard work on the show. My name is Sam. For Rich and Tina, thank you, per usual. And joining us...
One more thank yous, it turns out. We're adding people to the thank you list every week.
I was going to thank my landlord, too, but I don't know. He didn't really...
Show's getting more complex as we go... As we go Zoom, it's getting way more complex, it sounds like.
So two guests per usual, and we actually went to the respective law firms. So we have two from Bryce Downey and Lenkov and two from McDermott, Will & Emery. So I feel like I'm going to get jumped at the end of this, perhaps. But Juan Anderson joining us from BDL. He's an income member there. Hi, Juan.
How are you, sir?
Doing well. And Bill Donovan, co-chair of the Class Action Group and also a partner at McDermott, Will & Emery, based out of Los Angeles. Welcome, Bill.
Thank you, Sam.
I have to point out that unlike Bill, Juan decided to dress up for today's Zoom. Juan is one of the best dressed attorneys I know. Got the bow tie. He's got a wide collection of bow ties. And former winner of, formerly profiled in Chicago Magazine's Best Dressed Lawyers edition, right?
For the month of November 2013.
Ooh, a lot of bow ties.
I've been doing this a long time, guys.
But Donovan, you look great too, of course.
That's outstanding. That's outstanding. All right, let's start. We got seven topics, Rich, and we begin with militia groups.
So are militias legal, right? I mean, that's the big legal question that a lot of us are talking about, because we see the rise of militias with the Kenosha incident, guy coming up from Illinois with his own gun and deciding on his own with no authority to protect the business. And of course, we now know that there's a couple people that have been shot as a result. The question is, are militias legal? Is what he did protected under the Second Amendment, for example? A couple of answers there. Well, clearly the Second Amendment allows for individuals to bear arms. It talks about a well-regulated militia for their own protection. It says nothing about protecting someone else's business. And in fact, every state, including Wisconsin, including Illinois, where we are, has clear laws that make it illegal to act in the way that he acted in the name of a militia. So that should be, unquestioned, that militias acting outside the scope of any police authority or, government authority is illegal, period. Governor of every state has the right as commander in chief to mobilize people. So militias are not legal in that way. There's been a lot of talk, and I think we talked about it last time, about whether, maybe not last time, but this individual can assert self-defense. Again, there's two incidents. There's the one where he shot someone protecting a car lot that he had nothing to do with. I think he's done on that case. I don't think he has any self-defense argument. He has more of a self-defense argument when we're dealing with him being attacked on the ground. We saw the video of him shooting someone. But again, that will be, I think, tough to assert given all the circumstances involved here. But Tina, what are your thoughts on militias in general? Should regular people be allowed to take up arms when they perceive the government as not doing so themselves?
I mean, there are clear laws on what you can and can't do in the context of militias. I mean, I believe in the Second Amendment to a certain extent. I don't have a gun. I'm not necessarily saying I want a gun or that I want folks to have guns, but there is this sort of dichotomy, right? But at the end of the day, there are laws and rules about this sort of activity, and you need to be trained in a certain way. This whole notion of claiming that you're part of a militia to justify dangerous behavior is just, to me, is not acceptable.
In Wisconsin, it's a felony to assume, quote, to assume to act in an official capacity or to perform an official function, knowing that he or she is not the public officer that he or she assumes to be. We know that this guy has wanted to be a police officer forever. He put that on social media. So this seems to be a clear violation of at least Wisconsin law.
Well, in Wisconsin, and specifically when we're talking about an incident like Kyle Rittenhouse, two things jump out with that incident. He was 17 and he had an AR-15. So, Wisconsin law says it's an open carry state for all over 18. And this guy was clearly not covered by the open carry provisions of Wisconsin law. And an AR-15 in Wisconsin is required to be registered with the ATF and the local sheriff and chief of police. So before we even get to whether he should not have been 17 out in the street with an automatic rifle in Wisconsin.
All right. So let's assume that, Bill, it's an 18-year-old. He's legally allowed to carry a gun. Does that make it okay? Should civilians be allowed to act when they perceive police not acting?
No. I think the answer is clearly no. It's dangerous and unlawful, as folks have suggested. In Wisconsin, as in other states, you've got local police, you've got state police, there's the National Guard, some states have sheriffs, and there's private security. All those people are licensed, trained. Obviously, things don't go well all the time, despite that training, as we've seen, and that's one of the reasons why there's issues in Kenosha. But the idea that an individual has the right to leave their state, go to a different state, and enact their version of the law is going to lead our country to a very dangerous place.
All right, Bill and everyone else, we saw in Chicago record, numbers of people literally destroying lives by looting stores, destroying businesses. And in fact, we saw just a few weeks ago in our city, there were stores that were protected by individuals, citizens with guns, and by a lot of accounts, the looters went right around them, went by them. They weren't going to take the chance. seem to work. No? Sam?
Yeah, well, that's a different question. That's a
go
deterrent.
Go ahead, Juan. You take it.
Well, I mean, if you're talking about a deterrent, then, you know, yeah, it could work. But if the question is if it's legal and, you know, we're looking at this from a legal perspective, no, it's not. You cannot use deadly force to protect property. And there are very few and limited exceptions to that. And one of which is that, you know, if you think that you personally are confronting imminent danger and bodily harm. But the use of firearms to like shoot at people because they're going to rob your store. I mean, particularly when the store isn't yours and you're not at your own home, it calls into question, you know, your motives. Nobody grabs an AR-15 to go protect the neighborhood TJ Maxx. They grab it to shoot people.
Let's move to topic two here, and let's focus on Jussie Smollett, Kim Fox, Dan Webb. There's a triangle that keeps brewing here, and the Chicago Tribune, Tina, put out a new story today about Jussie Smollett.
So, you know, the big news, the latest news is that, and this is a story that we've covered a lot on Legal Face-Off, is that Dan Webb had, as you know, and as all of us know, had released his report a number of days ago saying that while he didn't find that Kim Fox or her office had done anything on a criminal front, that he found that they had abused their discretion and had misled the public, which leads us all to believe that, you know, there's going to be further investigation on it. The Cook County judge that was asked to look at whether or not the full report could be disclosed declined to release the full report, stating that there was a lot of grand jury material that was in it, and for that reason didn't want to release it. Also mentioned that there was a good chunk of what Webb did include in his release that was culminated from other sources. And so it's going to be interesting to watch how this continues to unfold. But bottom line, I think that this is a, you know, that this is a story to be continued, as we discussed with a couple of our guests earlier in the show.
It's a complete bucket of bullshit, if that's even a term. I mean, I'm watching Biden on my screen. Biden likes to talk about malarkey. I mean, this is nuts, right? I mean, Bill said earlier, you can't make this up. So we have the whole debacle of Smollett, right, in which someone made up a ridiculous crime and then was charged, and then suddenly that was dropped. For who knows why. So that made us the laughingstock of the entire world. Made our legal system look like a joke. What happens? They appoint a special prosecutor. Special prosecutor says our state's attorney lied. She's our chief law enforcement officer, and she lied. Yet, maybe she didn't do something criminal, so we're not going to release the rest of the report. What? That's all nuts. I mean, release the report.
Rich. I don't think that's what he said. I think that this is a to be continued. I don't think that this is over yet.
The judge said he's not releasing the rest of the report. Why not? What could possibly be in the report that the rest of us can't see? Release the report. Let the chips fall where they may. But even if we don't see the report, like Judge O'Brien said earlier, it's enough to me as a voter that she lied about her conduct. I mean, that should be enough. So continues to be a joke.
I think that's why there's this sense of urgency about the report, is because the whole process has become politicized, because we have an election coming up and people want to know before they vote whether they should vote for Kim Fox again.
Yeah, right, we do. I do, of course. As a Cook County voter, I want to know if there is something more to her release of Jussie Smollett before I vote, of course. Isn't that fair?
It is fair. Well, in addition to the election, though, we're all seeing that public confidence in institutions generally has declined and declined materially in recent years. And I think, as we talked about before we started, this instance is a perfect example of why people don't trust government and they don't trust public officials. So, Rich, I totally agree with you. I think the public's got the right to know, because you're about to cast an important vote. But even if there were no election, right, even if the election was 4 years off, I think the public fundamentally has a right to know what our elected officials are doing. And if they're acting within the bounds of decency and the law, terrific. If they're not, the public has a right to do something about it. And this is just a sort of a very difficult and dangerous set of facts.
Juan, what are you saying?
Well, I think the question for me, you know, I don't have a problem with the judge's order as it stands right now. I mean, basically it says there's grand jury information in there. And a lot of it is duplicative as with regards to what's already out there. I think for me, it was just, you know, hey, our state's attorney may have cut a sweet one-of-a-kind deal with a Hollywood celebrity when she had initially said the case against him was very strong. And then all of a sudden, the charges are dropped. So I think, you know, to your point, Bill, it is somewhat typical of Hollywood celebrities to get this kind of treatment from our elected officials. And some of us are just tired of it and we don't want the cover up. But I do agree with you as well, Tina, this has to play out. I mean, we're talking about 6 counts of disorderly conduct. That's what Webb recharged Smollett with in February. So, I mean, we're not talking about, nobody's going to jail about this, but you know, the stain on Kim Fox's office is something that, you know, she's going to have to deal with. And I think ultimately answer for either now or in an election.
Topic number 3 involves Big Ten football, which is right in our backyard. And as of now, still no concrete plans to have Big Ten football. And Nebraska filed a lawsuit a little bit ago. Omaha.com with the article here. The Big Ten unveiled an 11-3 vote in favor of postponing sports. And they, of course, Tina, have responded to what Nebraska put in play.
Yeah, I mean, and I'd love to hear your thoughts, Sam, and others. I mean, the gist is that they really laid into the lawsuit that was filed that was really, you know, challenging what the basis of that decision was. And, you know, bottom line, they said there was an 11-3 vote that took place and the decision was not, you know, some sort of an arbitrary or capricious decision that hadn't been thought out. It had been carefully considered. And, you know, based on this brief that was filed, they're encouraging the Nebraska football players that filed this to dismiss, you know, and to essentially dismiss the case, because it does seem to be, I mean, I understand why it was filed, but I find it interesting that they challenged whether or not there was a process behind it. I mean, Sam, what do you think as our illustrious sportscaster?
Well, I've heard the latest rumor is that the Big Ten may try and start a season by Thanksgiving. But the postponement's going to happen because we were supposed to have games within the next 2 weeks. That's not going to happen, at least in the Big Ten. But they are trying to get this season underway by Thanksgiving. It will get political, too. And if you think it's not going to get political, you are not paying attention. Think about the states in the Big Ten. Michigan, Ohio, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania. Are those all swing states? Yes, they are.
Trump tweeted that we're on the 1 yard line. Does he mean with 99 yards to go or with 1 yard to go? Who knows? Who knows what he means? But Bill, you're a Pac-10 guy. Pac-10's obviously getting put on hold too. I mean, I think my feeling is, while I agree with the postponement, good for the players for taking some affirmative action. You know, as a lawyer, I always think that people should avail themselves of the legal system when they feel wronged.
Look, I agree with you, Rich. I think that the part of the lawsuit that makes sense is the Big Ten has rules, like the other conferences have rules, and there's nothing wrong with making sure that the Big Ten followed its own procedures in deciding to postpone play. But I do think that now that the evidence has come out that apparently the Big Ten fully satisfied their own rules and regulations, the players ought to focus on football. I'm old enough to remember Tom Osborne's Nebraska teams that would win national championships or get awfully close. I noticed that the Nebraska team last year was second to last in the division, only ahead of Northwestern. So while I support their ability to sue, and I think that they've essentially accomplished what they reasonably could accomplish, I guess the recommendation from out west is if they want to play in the Rose Bowl anytime soon, the Nebraska kids ought to go back on the field and practice, and maybe that'll be more fruitful going forward.
Hey, Juan, push back on this. Yeah. We're having a feisty legal face-off today, which is great. Push back on Bill's idea that you're a football player, your only job is to play football, which, by the way, and don't have the gall to speak up, even though we're making billions of dollars off your likenesses and play without you seeing a penny. So don't have the tenacity, or don't have the temerity, I guess, to file a lawsuit. That's what sounds like Bill is saying.
Well, you know, I think some of this calls into question the way we classify these athletes. Are they students or are they, you know, pretty much independent contractors playing football? And as a student, I don't think you get to question the, you know, the Big Ten's deliberative process. as a student.
Come on.
As an athlete, though, I think it was interesting that part of the procedural attacks on the decision, they made a claim that there was interference with business opportunities to market themselves in the NFL. That's what this is really about. You've got college seniors who are about to graduate, go to NFL, have to rely on the previous season's work to get a professional career going. So that's what this is really about. It's about that kind of opportunity to make money. And I think, you know, listen, any game could spell the end of, you know, your professional opportunities. You could, you know, roll an ankle and that's over. That's not the league's fault. But I think if you've got 14 kids at one school amongst 10 plus other schools with hundreds of thousands of students, you know, I mean, whose opinion weighs more here? I think I'm with the Big Ten on this one and their ability to kind of address these procedural issues, say that's done, and also say to them, hey, listen, we can make these decisions in the best interest of, you know, all the students. You're a student and not, you know, we're not going to carve out a special area for you as a student athlete.
Topic four involves a company that I just don't know what it is. And now I'm showing my lack of intelligence, Tina, but I'll just defer to you. A lawyer cannot sue over a poor AVO rating. Is it AVO? AVO? I have no idea. Clean this
AVO.
Up.
AVO. 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 So, yeah. So this was an interesting one out of Seattle. So a lawyer had filed a $1.5 million defamation suit against AVO for information that he claims made him look terrible. There were a couple things going on here. First, he had a really low AVO rating. It was like 3.1 out of 10. The second was that there was information on the posting relating to his bar status, claiming that he was not active, but disabled. And so he sued for a number of things, including defamation, tortious interference, intentional infliction of emotional distress, and disability discrimination. To get to the punchline, a lot of this was tossed out. He was given an opportunity to amend his complaint by the judge, which he has done. But, you know, some of the more interesting stuff in this case was that you can't really sue over a low AVO rating on the basis of defamation because people's ratings are First Amendment, which we've obviously seen as a recurring theme on this show. Second, with regard to the statements about whether or not his license was active and what the actual status of his license was, he claimed that they were defamatory per se and therefore didn't need to show actual damages. But, you know, it was just a pleadings issue. He's gone back to replead. I don't think this is going anywhere at all. But it's just interesting. We've actually seen cases like this before over the years on Legal Face-Off with people not liking their AVO ratings or any other types of ratings and then going to court over it.
Yeah. Shut up, buddy. I mean, yeah. You want a better AVO rating, then be a better lawyer, provide better service. I mean, it's like anything else. It's like Yelp or whatever. We're a review society, right? So there's always...
Hey, I get reviewed as an Uber passenger. So, I mean, Come on.
Yeah, life's about reviews.
I'm curious. What is your rating?
Juan, the Uber driver, gave him the one that he deserves, then he'd be out of business.
Yeah, I'm good. Well, thankfully, I don't get what I probably deserve in these Uber situations. But I thought it was interesting, though, that the court's order said that the rating was provided by AVO is really a statement of opinion that gets First Amendment protection. Okay, but if your rating is 3.1, doesn't that kind of suggest some kind of, you know, objective empirical calculation? You know, how does AVO arrive at 3.1? Like, is that really, you know, an opinion that they throw out there?
Oh, it's just a rating system, right? So it's a...
Yeah.
Yeah, but how do you get to it?
It should be an aggregation of actual reviews, right? And so as long as they're aggregating the reviews correctly, I'm with the group that this law should be thrown out. It lacks merit. There are Yelp reviews, other reviews that can have real impact on folks' businesses and on their future. But as long as there's no sort of bad faith by the rating company, I think the case should be thrown out. I will say that was my initial reaction to this lawsuit. And Tina, I did check, and neither you nor I have AVO ratings. So I can confirm that we have no reason to challenge our rating. And so I stand by my initial view that the lawsuit should be tossed.
If we can't,
Durbin's taking care of that, right, Bill?
Yeah, I mean, look, if we had been below 3-1, I think my view of the lawsuit might have been different.
I'll admit that, but we're right. Good. And remember, Sam, rate us and review us on social media.
Yeah, and check your AVO score. Otherwise, you're in trouble. All right, on to the favorite actor of Rich Lenkov, Ron Jeremy. He's in trouble. He's in some hot water here. Rich, you want to dive in?
Ron Jeremy was one of the stars of the 70s, 80s adult film industry. But yes, yeah, fallen on some hard times. Started a couple of reality shows a few years ago. But yeah, some serious charges by the LA district attorney, including sexual assault of a minor. Some involved are as young as 15, allegedly. 28 counts of sexual violence against 13 women over many years. He's already been in jail for some of them. This week, the district attorney announced, as I said, that they're adding some more charges. So, you know, this story was interesting, not just because who it is, but I imagine part of his defense would be, you know, that these women, inevitably women will be attacked, right? Anytime we see allegations of sexual assault, rape, unfortunately, one of the tried and true tactics is to go after the accuser. So I was just thinking, I wonder if, you know, one of those defenses will be they were attracted to a celebrity. They knew that what they were getting involved with, given that he was a, you know, adult film star. None of which should have any bearing, but I bet that's some of what Ron Jeremy's attorneys will throw out there.
Yeah, I agree with you, Rich. And I mean, the guy is just as creepy now as he was a few years ago. I mean, I'm just looking at these mug shots and he just looks, I mean, I would not want to go anywhere near this guy. So, but I completely agree with you that in what appears based on what we know to be an otherwise really tough spot for him based on these alleged acts, that will likely be a defense. We've seen it before.
I mean, the guy is 67 years old. He's facing 90 years in prison with all of this. And, you know, I think the consent issue is one that's going to be, you know, most at issue with these facts. I mean, let's face it, Ron Jeremy was probably, in most of these instances, if you look at all of the accusers, he was surrounded by women whose society has determined to have, you know, less value because they were either adult film stars or, you know, people who were struggling with drug addiction, et cetera. And that was his kind of shtick to get them, compliant. So what you have is, you know, him spending years and years preying on, you know, the fact that, you know, these women are not going to be seen as somebody who would withhold consent from him. Him being the adult film star that he is. So, you know, I think he has come upon these charges at a wrong time in history. He's probably not going to escape some punitive measures from this.
Speaking of movie stars, those two nerds on TikTok that were hosting parties during the pandemic, they are in trouble now, and they have been charged, I believe, is it misdemeanor or felony? Misdemeanors. They were charged for holding house parties during the pandemic, Rich.
I'm sick of these videos. You know, as someone who is holed up in my little world here, and I'm sick to death of these a-holes who are having these massive house parties right by where Donovan lives.
I didn't get the invite even. I didn't get the invite.
I
wouldn't have gone. And Rich, I agree with you. Look, I to go back to our first story for a second, right? The militia group. I think the TikTok story is the flip side of the same coin, where there were too many people out there who were putting the general public at risk because they think they're above the law or the law doesn't apply to them, right? The mayor in Los Angeles has been very strict on what we can and can't do. And all of us who are Angelenos have had to avoid having friends over doing other things we like to do. We couldn't go to the beach for a while, okay? But the idea that these two guys can somehow have their parties, put everybody at risk, shouldn't be tolerated, and I'm glad that they've made an example of him, and I hope they shut this conduct down. because people are going to get sick. And if they're around people more vulnerable, people could die because of these parties. It's just not good. It's not safe.
Juan, any TikTok parties that you're hosting that we can come by for?
Yeah, the only you can come by and, you know, I can have a party trying to chase the rabbits out of my backyard. That's about it. But, you know, the Rich, you know my feelings about millennials and, you know, their, you know, kind of devil may care attitude about blowing off and things that are important to everybody else but them.
Sam.
Sam. Yo, Sam.
Talking to you, Sam, was that fast pen?
I just don't understand this way of thinking and, you know, this way of, you know, being a functioning member of society. Like, I don't get it. I hope they cut off the electricity, the water, you know, all the, you know, all of it.
I'd go for just shutting down their app as a start and, you know.
Yeah. Maybe exactly. Then they wouldn't be living in the Hollywood Hills.
And TikTok doesn't need any other bad publicity at the moment for reasons we all know anyway. That's another reason why it was bad timing and bad decisions.
I'm starting a TikTok video while we speak, by the way. Jump in. Nice.
Those two TikTokers have a combined following of 19 million people.
Wow.
That's insane to me. And people do what they say, unfortunately. And apparently they just go to parties. All right, so we've got four attorneys on this call here on Legal Face Off. Let's remember the Chadwick Boseman portrayal of Thurgood Marshall. Unfortunately, Boseman passed away last week. Very sad story. Only 43 years young. He was fighting cancer and still making movies and making them masterfully, I might add. But Boseman as Thurgood, how was he?
Yeah, you know, we try to focus on legal stories. And, of course, the legal world covers so many different aspects. And in this case, like you mentioned, the great Chadwick Boseman, who just passed away, did. I think we covered this movie on our show. We might have done a movie review. We frequently do movie reviews with some pretty prominent movie critics of movies that involve the law or lawyers. And Chadwick Boseman, a few years ago, did portray Thurgood Marshall, who, of course, is one of the most prominent Supreme Court justices in history, groundbreaking attorney. And at the start of his career, he was a solo practitioner, struggling lawyer, looking to make his name, and handled a lot of civil rights cases. And one of them is portrayed in the amazing film called Marshall. And Chadwick Boseman did just a really incredible job. And it was interesting. I was listening to an interview after he died with Bill Simmons, and they asked him about how he approached portraying all these, you know, real life people. He portrayed, of course, Jackie Robinson in 42 and James Brown in Get On Up. And he said he didn't try to do an impersonation of people. He just tried to sort of be himself. And in Marshall, you know, just did an amazing job, really credibly, I think, portraying an interesting case in the life of one of the most important jurists to come along. So great job by Chadwick Boseman in that movie. Tina, did you see Marshall or any of the other
films? I did. It was a wonderful movie. I mean, he was just a terrific talent. So sad. I don't think anybody really knew what was going on with him. I saw a picture of him, and I'm sure you guys may have seen it too, of him with Kobe Bryant. And it just, that picture sort of sums up 2020 in just an image. Just so sad and tragic.
Bill, at the beginning of the pandemic, I put a list together of movies that I wanted to watch with my kids. I put together a list of entertainment, but educational films that I thought would be important for them and maybe a way for them to learn a little bit about things. One of them was Marshall, because I really wanted them to, you know, understand the legacy of Thurgood Marshall. Of course, they completely ignored my list and went on to watch, you know, some of the worst garbage in history. But, you know, really movies like this, when portraying people like Thurgood Marshall, lawyers, famous cases, they're really a great way to get into these stories that might be a little bit hard to get into just by reading case law or history books.
Look, I totally agree. We need more Thurgood Marshalls. We need more John Lewis's, right? May he rest in peace. Thurgood Marshall made this country great. And without taking the risks that he did, we would be in a different place. I'm convinced of it. I think he was an incredible jurist, an incredible lawyer. Even if he didn't agree with every opinion at the Supreme Court, that wasn't the point. The point was he transformed this country. I thought the acting was strong. I saw the movie on a plane and was riveted by it. And I think with the three folks we're talking about, including John Lewis, the loss of all three is bad for the country. We need more heroes, not less. we need to look up to people and not read tweets from people that make us scratch our head as to what person's thinking. So I hope that the legacy of all these folks is remembered and cherished. And again, we need more of them.
Juan, you and I have talked about these issues for hours and hours. And in your office, in your actual office, you've got a big poster of Thurgood Marshall. So I know he's an important figure in your life. And talk to us about how you think Chadwick Boseman did right by his portrayal of Thurgood Marshall.
I mean, Thurgood Marshall is from my part of the country. I'm from D.C. He, came up in the Baltimore area. And in my office, you're right, there is a huge picture of the cover of the book my namesake Juan Williams did on Thurgood Marshall's life, which is actually signed by Juan Williams. So he has been a model for me for a long time. And I think I've watched this movie three times, and I could do a whole show just on Thurgood Marshall and this movie. At the time that this case came about, Marshall was only 32 years old. I mean, he was already widely known as a very capable trial lawyer. He was the chief trial lawyer for the NAACP at the time. And he was traveling through the South trying these cases. And this is 15 years before Brown versus Board of Education. And so what was poignant to me is that this case was not in the Deep South. This is not Alabama or Mississippi. This is in Greenwich, Connecticut. And even then, you know, he had to face the same level of racial scrutiny there as he would have in the Deep South. And, you know, there are some parallels between what he encountered in 1940 and what, you know, we're dealing with now. This is the confluence of sex, money, and racial stereotypes that we saw, you know, 50 years later with O.J. Simpson. So, I mean, the whole way that they put this movie on, and the way that Boseman portrayed him, I can't stop watching. I probably will watch it probably two or three more times now that, you know, this is a topic on this show. I can't get enough. I thought he did a great job.
Sam, final word on his portrayal, Chadwick Boseman portrayal of Jackie Robinson in 42. You're our sports guy.
I thought he was amazing. Not only is Thurgood Marshall, not only is Jackie Robinson, but is James Brown and is the Black Panther. I mean, he was incredible. And to think about all the roles that he put forth when he was sick. I mean, we didn't even know that he was sick. But, I mean, to answer your question, big picture, he was outstanding in 42. And I think he really played into how tough it was to be a Black American playing baseball. And, again, a triple threat, right? I mean, baseball, basketball, and track. And you felt like it was Jackie Robinson. I thought he was incredible.
Don't forget, he also portrayed Floyd Little early in his career, a football player. So he was pretty adept at playing a lot of athletes.
Bill Donovan.
Money well spent by Denzel.
It's very true. Bill Donovan, Juan Anderson, thank you. Your time is complete here on the Legal Grab Bag. Thanks for joining us.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab, so hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget the...